towards the One. So today we're continuing a cycle of teachings that we began more than a year ago. So those that are visiting from afar or have come anew, you are most welcome. But do know that you're sort of getting plopped down in the middle of a series of teachings. And it's a very challenging body of teachings because it's dealing with the ego, and who of us wants to talk about that or think much about it? The fact is that we need that ego. It does help us along the way. But the problem is when it becomes our master, then we are in trouble. And we lose our balance. And we lose our way. We can. And that's part of course, our evolution towards illumination. But I want to make everyone very aware that there was such a vast amount of knowledge that was shared by Hazrat and Iacon and others. And it would be as if we take one note of a symphony and think it's the whole symphony. Or one surah from the Quran and think it's the whole Quran. Or one passage from the Holy Bible and think that's the whole substance. So it can be a lifelong study. But it is also very simple. We know that some of these things we know, we probably knew better as children rather than when we grew up. So perhaps you'll hear that ring of truth from that time of more innocence within your own heart and mind and body. And I'm going to do my best to try to show different facets by bringing in other teachings that are, you know, I think people have to have a lot of patience coming to these classes, or if you've listened to them online, because it's kind of like we're spiraling, you know, it's as if you have this precious jewel, but you have to also have a precious setting for it, and it takes time for that to kind of set the jewel. So, you know, we'll go around it and try to highlight different aspects of the teaching today. I always like to begin, or I frequently like to begin, with this prayer, and it's the noonday prayer by Hazrat Anayat Khan, and the prayer is called Salat. The prayer is very beautiful because it highlights various masters, saints, and prophets, known and unknown. The language of the prayer is written in a more formal form of English, and I will say that the various prophets that are listed are in their masculine form, but we like to take a moment in between the recitation of each of those names to have a moment of silence to remember the feminine dimension. Sometimes those things that are not spoken are much more subtle and can be very powerful. So although the name isn't invoked aloud, the name is present in the vibration. Most gracious Lord, Master, Messiah, and Savior of humanity, we greet thee in all humility. Thou art the first cause and the last effect, the divine light and the spirit of guidance, Alpha and Omega. Thy light is in all forms, thy love in all beings, in a loving mother, in a kind father, in an innocent child, in a helpful friend, in an inspiring teacher. Allow us to recognize thee in all thy holy names and forms as Rama, as Krishna, as Shiva, as Buddha, and in many other names and forms, known and unknown to the world. I'm mixing the words up, but you follow me. Let us know thee as Abraham, as Solomon, as Zarathustra, as Moses, as Jesus, and in many other names and Muhammad, excuse me, and in many other names and forms, known and unknown to the world. We adore thy past. Thy presence deeply enlightens our being, and we look for thy blessing in the future. O Messenger, Christ, Nabi, the Rasul of God, thou whose heart constantly reaches upward, thou comest on earth with a message as a dove from above, when Dharma decayeth, and speakest the word that is put into thy mouth, as the light filleth the crescent moon. May the star of the divine light shining in thy heart be reflected in the hearts of thy devotees. May the message of God reach far and wide, illuminating and making the whole of humanity as one single brotherhood in the fatherhood of God. One could also say in that last line, as one single unity in the beingness of God. It's important that the words not get in the way, but that we experience the essence of the vibration. And the intent, of course, is an invocation to all those, whether known or unknown to the world, who have brought light and wisdom to us. So taking just a moment more at the beginning here to feel those who have especially illuminated your path. And remember, in the prayer, it says, in a loving mother, in a kind father, in an innocent child, in a helpful friend, an inspiring teacher. Our Murshid Hazrat Anai Khan had a special tree in his garden, an apricot tree, that he always went to initiate people. It may be something of nature. And our Murshid Samuel Lewis had a fig tree that he was very fond of. So it may be something in nature that inspires you. Also, the elemental world teaches us. Leo. Leo. Glasses be gone. Quiet. You quiet. So as I said, the teachings today are on gathas, morals, the training of the mental ego, and it also, you find it in other, there have been many compilations of Hazrat Anai Khan's teachings, which were, for the most part, verbal teachings that were recorded. So there is another title that is sometimes given to this paper, which is called The Training of the Ego, Training by Not Satisfying, or excuse me, Gratifying Vanity. It reads like this. The first form of the ego is that which the body helps to form, and the next is that which is formed by the mind. So even if we take that first sentence, we know that this is very true. From a physical point of view, the mind, the body starts to take form even in the mother, the womb of the mother. And of course, there are a lot of debates and conversations among many spiritual people, probably wiser than I myself, perhaps, you know, when consciousness comes into that being. But at any rate, we know that there's the spark of life and the body begins to take form. And one could say that mind, in the traditional sort of Western psychology sense, begins to form at birth, and one begins to experience this world in this dimension. Murshid goes on to say, this aspect of ego lives for vanity. I think it's good to put it in the perspective of even a child, because we know that often children will do things and say, look, mommy, look, daddy. They want that feedback. You know, that's a form of perhaps wanting some sort of self-recognition or acknowledgement. One could say that's vanity. Not that any of these things are completely good or bad. We sort of develop our sense of who we are in the world, and the world feeds that a lot, so we know that. But here we're in the spiritual teachings, and we can look at things from a different perspective. So this aspect of the ego lives for vanity, which causes a person to do good and also to do evil. And who amongst us, even as a child, tried to do very, very good things, but maybe when others weren't looking, we maybe did some little things that were bad. But we thought there was a gain in it. You know, think of it that way. If we have a hard time thinking of it now as adults, we know it's true and we can even kind of laugh at that. It happens, even that as a child, we'll do something like that. Its desire is always the satisfaction of its pride. This aspect of the ego. Its desire is always the satisfaction of its pride. And when this increases, in the end, it results in tyranny and cruelty. So that can happen too. And we see that sometimes, and we know throughout history that leaders have sometimes, well, we've seen it somewhat recently too, where we, leadership, and empowered by all of us, we can't be exempt from that, can have an aspect of tyrannical dictatorship or autocratic behavior. This is very easy to happen when you surround yourself with advisors who only tell you what's good about you, whether or not it's true. Your best friends will let you know your faults in a gentle, loving way, hopefully. It's good. We should be grateful. A person expects others to see him as he thinks he is. And often his self-esteem is excessive, and it is impossible for others to admire him as much as he wants. A person expects others to see him as he thinks he is. And often his self-esteem is excessive, and it is impossible for others to admire him as much as he wants. So here Murshid is touching on this aspect of desire. And we know that in the Buddhist teaching, sometimes it talks about things, it's in relationship to the teachings and our capacity to retain them, but about that leaky pot that has a hole in it. And we can also have those holes within ourselves, that place that no matter how much it gets fed, it's not enough. We need that constant feedback, that constant mirroring. Remember the practice, some of you know very well because we've talked about it, that my grandmother had, which I think is a very high spiritual practice. She was a sibling of 10 brothers and sisters. It's easy to get lost in that kind of brood. Right? From time to time. And also, they had come from Italy, so they were trying to make it in this new country, challenges of language and so forth, although my grandfather was a well-respected craftsperson, or my great-grandfather, I should say. So my grandmother sometimes felt marginalized. She coped with it in her later years, she really was a very extraordinarily beautiful woman. People always felt that, like movie star beautiful, kind of. And I asked her one day when I was very little, and I didn't call her grandma or grandmother, I called her Anne, her name. And I said, "Anne, why are you so beautiful?" And she said, "Do you want to know my secret?" And I said, "Yes, I do. I really do." And she said, "Well, come with me and I'll show you." And she went into, you know, then they had those dressing kind of tables with a vanity and the mirrors like this. And she put her hand on her chin and she looked back and forth in the mirror at herself. And she said to herself, "I love you and you're beautiful. I love you and you're beautiful." She believed that. And you know, even you've seen the most, sometimes, in myself at least, I know Joe knows this, in India, you know, some of the people that are can be rather hideous from leprosy, some of them are my friends. And they're very beautiful. That's because their soul's so beautiful and loving. So it's not a matter of image, although my grandmother, in her instance, she was beautiful, but it's what's coming through, how one sees oneself. And one good friend of mine, a leper there, you know, he has really a lot of dignity and is doing a lot for his children to keep them well and have them educated. That person is a beautiful person, no matter how many toes or fingers or things he loses, you know? There's a dignity to that. But how do we see ourselves is what's important, yes? What do we mirror back to ourselves? The world can mirror back, as Murshid said, cruelty and tyranny. Sometimes I say to people, it's good to be like Teflon. Just let it slide off. Or don't they have that expression? Maybe it won't be easy to understand for those, but I think you'll understand because it's probably a common expression. But like water off a duck's back, right? Like water off a duck's back. I think also it's important as we read onward, think that Murshid was in India his whole life and in the West only from 1910 until 1927 when he passed. So this is coming from a culture that is very different than ours. If you've been to different parts of the world, especially in India where there is a wealth of embellishment on the architecture, embellishment in the manner of dress, you'll get an idea of the context that this is given. But I think there is some application also. You know, he came to the West and then people were dressed in black and high collars and, you know, they weren't as embellished as they are in India. So this is kind of within that context. So listen to this then. He says, "One wishes to be admired for his clothes, his jewels, his possessions." Also keeping in mind the caste system was still there, even though they say, no, it's not. The caste system is still alive in India. It's democratic, but it's still there. "One wishes to be admired for his clothes, his jewels, his possessions, his greatness and position. And naturally, when this desire increases, it makes a person blind and he loses sight of right and justice." It is natural that the desire for things that gratify vanity should have no end. It increases continually. It is natural, he says, that the desire for things that gratify vanity should have no end. It increases continually. The tendency to look at others with hatred and prejudice, to consider them inferior to oneself, and all such tendencies come from this ego. If you've ever been in a household where there are servants, sometimes this can happen. Not for a person of equanimity and mutual respect, but sometimes this can happen, where people can be treated badly. And you can see this sometimes when you travel to other parts of the world, where people are enslaved because of their life circumstances in a household. Again, Murshid is talking about that, but now we're seeing it in the workforce very alive here in America, at least. I can't speak for other countries, but with the financial situation we're encountering, we know that the rights of workers have become infringed upon, and things are very threatening now. And you're expected to tolerate it or else get out of the way. There are hungry people waiting for your job. This is also a form of it that's arising now within our own culture, our own society, here in America. There are even cases when people spend money in order to be able to insult another, to make someone bow before him, to make him give way, to put him in a position of inferiority, to make him appear contemptible. Sometimes a person will spend money. The desire for the satisfaction of vanity reaches such a point that a person would give his life for the satisfaction of his vanity. We see that also historically, that that's happened in battles and wars, which could be considered a form of vanity. But today, it's becoming very common practice for people to have plastic surgery. And you know, some people risk their lives doing it. Anytime you have invasive surgery, it makes the body very susceptible. But people willingly do it for the sake of their vanity. And not just women, men too, are doing it. They want those washboard apps. They're having inserts and implants. All kinds of things are happening. The whole phenomena of tattooing also. Body piercing in very severe ways. Implants. So it's all part of that. We'll get to some practices, by the way, but I want to just give you a view of this teaching. Often someone shows generosity not for the sake of kindness, but to satisfy his vanity. Often someone shows generosity not for the sake of kindness, but to satisfy his vanity. The more vanity a person has, the less sympathy he has for others. For all his attention is given to his own satisfaction, and he is as blind towards others. And again, we see this, we've seen this happen in our financial institutions, even in our lending institutions, where things have been excessive and out of balance because one's vanity wants a bigger house, a fancier car, more of something that they really don't need. Or we also see where there have been investors that have taken money from others, brought crashes upon thousands of lives and ultimately their own. The ego, so to speak, restricts life because it limits a person. This ego, so to speak, restricts life because it limits a person. It's kind of like putting ourselves in prison. Coldness, pride, jealousy, all come from the ego. coldness, pride, jealousy all come from the ego. Again, in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about the antidotes. You know, what is the antidote for coldness? What is the antidote for pride? What is the antidote for envy or jealousy? Generosity. So there are things that, you know, feeling a sense of love, meditating on loving kindness, the practice of really true and essential generosity. I mean, these are things that, you know, maybe you have to fake it till you make it even. But it's good to bring that into our awareness and think about what is that antidote, and also what is the indication. You know, if we're jealous or envious of someone, is it because they touch some inadequacy in us? There really is enough to go around. The problem with the world is that we don't think there is, and we hoard. We hoard in one way or another, or take more than our share. Now, in Sanskrit, it's called mudita, sympathetic joy, having a vibration that when someone has some good fortune, that we have a sympathetic joy for them. It's a beautiful expression.
M-U-D-I-T-A?
M-U-D-I-T-A, mudita. Yeah. The more vanity a person has, the less sympathy he has for others. For all of his attention is given to his own satisfaction, and he is as blind towards others. This ego, so to speak, restricts life because it limits a person. Coldness, pride, jealousy all come from the ego. There is nothing so displeasing to the surroundings as conceit in whatever form. And what is the use of an opinion that is pleasing to us and displeasing to all our surroundings? You've heard the expression, bad news travels fast. Isn't it true? But if something good happens, does that get around very often? He has to ask why. You see that it's a perpetuation of a kind of vibration or limitation. Interesting, isn't it? Really interesting. Things are changing now, but I was very impressed. That was probably the first time in India, and I was listening to the radio, and they began the top of the hour with how many graduates there had been in New Delhi, and you know, all these wonderful bits of news about great things that had happened. And you know, it wasn't starting with, you know, top of the hour, you know, someone held hostage and whatever. It's a very, you know, at least it was. I have to say that it's all changing. The whole world is changing. We've been we're not all, I'm sorry to say, in America, we're not the best big brother, big sister to the world. Nonetheless, it's a great country. There's no other one like it, and I have to say we experience so many freedoms here that others don't. So it's a blessing to be born in America or to live here. In reality, a person's true satisfaction comes from opinion that others have of him, not his own opinion of himself. Well, that's a problem, isn't it? And it's very paradoxical, because we can never be true to ourselves if that's what we're waiting for, the opinions of others. In reality, a person's true satisfaction comes from the opinion that others have of him, not from his own opinion of himself. Hazrat Naik Khan goes on to say, there's nothing more repellent than a thorny ego. There's nothing more repellent than a thorny ego. The outward manner can hide an ego, that is not soft. The outward manner can hide an ego that is not soft, even if the manner is very, the outward manner cannot, very important, the outward manner cannot hide an ego that is not soft. Even if the manner is very humble, it shows itself suddenly, unconsciously, in a word or an action that jars upon another. And I could say, same coin, different sides. Pride, humility. If we're doing it for not naturally, we think we're acting a certain way, it's just a different side of the coin and it's all ego. I don't remember who said the quote, but it's something like, maybe Wahaba, you'll be able to help me out. Something like, not making other, you know, to not make others feel great by making ourselves little. There's some great quote, and I've lost the words, but the essence of that. And they're great beings that show us the way. Dalai Lama is a great living example right now. He is so, in one way, very humble, has great humor and great wit. He can even laugh at himself, which I think is a great, beautiful quality. But he's also very powerful in his own way. If he weren't, he wouldn't be able to uphold the people in exile. He's not a wimp. Mother Teresa, look at what she was able to do. Very powerful. Mahatma Gandhi. In one sense, empty of self for being and being a great servant to many, but leadership too. So interesting, and sometimes very seems very paradoxical, doesn't it? The outward manner cannot hide an ego that is not soft. Even if the manner is very humble, it shows itself suddenly, unconsciously, in a word or an action that jars upon another. Sometimes you can just, if you, even without the person saying one word, you see it. You see it in their face, in their expression, in the way they hold their body, in the way they move. You know. Any questions about what have just been read? Or thoughts?
We're supposed to, the ideal communication is to show empathy and agree with the person to show that we understand them. Mm-hmm. But when they're so out of love and maligning and putting things down, it's such a bore. I don't agree with them. And I know I should, but so what do I do?
I remember there's a great story of Anayat Khan was traveling to America on a ship. And someone was debating with him and said something like, oh, I have no belief in God whatsoever. And he said, well, we agree in one thing. He said, you yourself say you have a, that in of itself is a belief. You believe there's nothing, I believe there's something. So there we have a common impulse that we both believe.
Okay, I'll work with that.
Right? Yeah. And it's like, I think that having, Diane, it's like, what is underneath that? What is underneath? I think that's empathy. In one way, I understand completely, like there's something that comes up and it's like that vibration. You don't want it to even come towards you. Don't want it to come into you. You know, it can be just like a dark, gray, black cloud. it can be like a poison in the atmosphere. But at the same time, one might ask oneself, what is the impulse or the root of this kind of dissatisfaction in this person? And although it may not be our responsibility to draw their attention to it, but one could ask, maybe ask them if there's something underneath it. And if not, at least observe that
there is. An immature child that has to put down every other car or every other driver around, I say, look, they're thinking the same thing you're thinking, so cut it out, turn it around, you know.
Yeah.
Enough.
Yeah. But that is also coming from something else.
Yeah, insecure and unfulfilled and not content and feeling inadequate.
So I think also think about just what happens if you become like, instead of the wall or the door, you open the window, the vibration goes past, and you're sitting there and your equipoise and what you're breathing is, you are enough. You are satisfied.
Okay.
Just try it. It's very interesting how it will change. You don't have to say anything. People change.
Okay.
I have found that sometimes when I'm on the telephone with people that are, you know, I call it kind of winding up, you know, like they did the old sirens, you know, and I think, okay, they're obviously needing to get something off their chest, so I'm not going to really react to this, because my first impulse is like, run, hang up the phone. But then, you know, what I try to do is breathe. And I try to breathe back to them a feeling of contentment and ease. And I've even had people then say to me, are you still there? Hello? Are you still there? Mm-hmm. And in a way, no, because there's not a resistance. But yes, I am present. It's just that there's not an energetic response to it that's pushing back at them. And it's funny. It's like letting go of the rope in the play of the children, the tug of war, you know? And it's like, you know, even if you watch the training of the dogs or the animals, one of the things, Cesar Millan, who's my great teacher in so many ways, but he trains the dogs, you know, but it's like, you know, he's a great pack leader. So one of the things when a dog starts to accelerate like that, he gives them a little tap. I just did that with Leo and look at how he stopped and went, it was like, it's enough. They need that boundary, but it's to shift the mind. So sometimes when someone's doing that going on with the cars and the people, it's like, wow, look at that color on that tree, sometimes even just shifting their mind.
I do that all the time.
Do you?
You're tired.
You're tired.
I'm resisting. You know,
you are resisting. Yeah, I can even hear it when you're telling your story.
Agree and both go down to the
No, ground. No. That's not the point. Try it the other way and see what happens.
Say anything, Diane, and just say the mantra like a small prayer.
That's true. That's same. Do that.
Yeah, I do. I do it all.
Just don't say anything. You said they're acting like kids.
Or try to change the subject so we're talking about something that we love.
Yes.
If we're not talking about what we love, forget it.
Yeah. There's a great story of Ram Dass with his father before his father passed away. And he was, they were making jam or something together. You know, and his father was just, you know, I mean, they were from a very wealthy family, and of course their suffering was, you know, somebody's jet was bigger than theirs or something like that. I mean, you know, it was like that was suffering. But, you know, and the father was going off about something, and you know, his response was like most people's, like he didn't really want to listen to that scenario again. But he got his father's attention redirected to the, and I heard him tell this story, so this is, I don't know if it's documented, but I remember hearing him tell it. It was in a public venue. But he kind of just, you know, licked the jam and started commenting like, oh, do you really think it's sweet enough, Dad? Do you think we need to add? It totally shifted it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It got it all, it just like it lifted the needle. Old metaphor now, I don't know what I can use with the DVDs and all that. Right? It's like that metaphor is gone. Although they're coming back.
Pause.
Oh, that's it. Pause. Yeah. Yeah. I keep saying for Apple Z, for Control Z, for go backwards.
Well, I think the Dalai Lama in his present approach to what's going on with the Chinese government is also instructive in this regard, because he is refusing to fight strong enough that he is willing to relinquish his faith, leave it to the disposition of the Tibetan people in order to take the ammunition away, the energy away from that whole debate, because he understands that it's not about disposition, it's about control, and it's about the attempt of the Chinese government in this instance to control the Tibetan people and to control the world's perception, I guess, of the Dalai Lama and himself in this position, and he's just refusing to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what, I've followed him, of course, for many years, and I've just been amazed at his response. I mean, to me, that's very high stakes.
Very.
That's much higher stakes than any of us will probably have.
God will protect him.
But I think that's another example of this sort of...
Well, here's an even worse example.
wait, now I think you're doing what you say somebody else does.
Well, no, but it's
pertinent. Okay. Okay.
And I need help.
Okay.
My mother loves to denigrate and put me down always. And so it's Thanksgiving time, and I say, we have reservations at Seasons 52, 1 o'clock on Thanksgiving. Join us. And she says, oh no, she's going to cousin Simon's and all the family. And I say, well, great, enjoy. And she's absolutely furious, livid, control-freak game like the Dalai Lama, like the China, that I won't do it. And I could care less. I don't want any part of it, because a couple of holidays ago I was over there and her twin brother said, that baby wishes you were dead, you see, because there's money involved and they would much rather me be out of the picture because mother's stories about how bad I am. And let them wallow in their stories, I say. Go for it. So how in the world, I dismiss it, right? I do, but it never. Every day it's a haranguing. Out.
Open the door, let it pass by. Mm-hmm. Breathe. You know, Dalai Lama says that. It's a wonderful interview by him. And someone, he's trying to offer you some sympathy, obviously.
I don't want sympathy. I want her to see the light.
Look. So sweet. Animals know. They're very natural.
Like my favorite Haviland China that was grandmother's, she gave it to Simon without even consulting me. I mean, that's fine. I said, well, tell Simon I'd love to buy it back when she doesn't want it. You know, little nasty things like that. That's behind my back. Just
families can be that way. We all know.
And so the point being,
Say something?
What do you want from me? And tell me more. Tell me more.
We're gonna get back to the class now here, Diane. But I want to say... We'll talk about it later, but I do want to say, Diane, like wherever that cord is, wherever that hook is in you, I want you to try to meditate and try to disconnect that hook.
Absolutely, I do.
But I don't think it's yet done. I think it's with words, but I think that there's something very subtle that's still connected.
Well, it's with her. I know it's with both of us, but I'm happy to go anywhere else but there.
But I'm just saying that I can feel in you that there's this irritation, frustration, I think, anger. And I think that's very transformative. I don't think you should in any way, oppress that. You'll explode.
No,
but
I
think
I
that there.
It off like it's nothing.
But it is something.
Is, I'm furious.
It is something,
enough
yes.
Enough is enough. I don't want any more of it if I never see my mother again. I'm
that's right.
Happy.
So we're going to...
Knock on wood, that's the truth.
We're going to ask that you just... That you just You pray on the situation.
Yeah.
And as I said, the Dalai Lama, when asked if he gets angry at the Chinese, he laughed. Sometimes. Sometimes. He said, but then I think they're acting that way because of their confusion, their delusion. You remember this about your mother, your sister, their confusion, their delusion. We don't know, maybe past, these things were done to her in another way, and she's living that out, perpetuating it. And they said, well, what do you do? And he said, I breathe in all their anger, all their confusion, all their lack of understanding, and I send them love and light.
Should we light
and compassion.
A match to their anger and confusion and fury? Light a match and burn it?
Well, I'm saying what His Holiness did. He said that he actually was willingly absorbing that into his being, transforming it, and giving back love and light. Okay?
Thanks.
Yeah. It's not easy. It's a high practice. But
you can begin it wherever you are.
You can begin it wherever you are, and you know what? You can begin it with yourself.
Yep.
When you're feeling angry and confused and like you just want to scream about it, you absorb that into the inner part of your being where it becomes transformed into light to illuminate your path. So you have even an empathy towards yourself. An empathy towards yourself,
yeah,
and what you're feeling.
Definitely.
And you know, maybe you even invoke that little child of you that feels some hurt or wound,
yeah,
from it, and embrace her as if you are her mother, and you're giving her love, and you're giving her light, and you're giving her comfort, and you're giving her protection. Okay?
Yeah, but you don't think I should have to lower myself to go have Thanksgiving with them, do you?
I think you need to do what is right for you.
For me, right.
For you.
No,
yeah.
I said no.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's, if that's right for you, then that's what you need to do.
Thank you.
All right. So now I'd like to talk a little bit more, and I'd like to read a couple more things, and then we will get into a practice. But thank you, because I think that's not what you're going through. We all go through in some,
yeah,
ways. And it gives us a chance to all look at where those difficulties are, and where, because honestly, we can all sit here in some sort of blissful meditative state, but it's not worth it. Single cent if we can't apply it in our lives. And you've highlighted an instance where we all know that either in the workplace or with family or somehow this arises for us. And how do we cope with it? Well, we do what Dalai Lama tells us. We do what others have told us. We rely on the practice and we use the practice and we apply it when we have these challenging times.
And incidentally, the last trump was, I said, oh, but of course everyone's invited over after we come back down to the plaza to see the lights and, you know, blah, 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 all the big family. And of course they don't want that. They're just playing a tower game, Diane, blah.
That's
and
okay.
So I pulled the last
let it
one
be.
Test. I said, come on down afterwards.
Let it be.
Yeah.
Just let them be.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going on, though, to in the prior months, there was a teaching that Murshid gave that was training the ego, and it was specifically on the subject of vanity. I think it's good to refer back to that teaching. I'm going to read a few lines, and then again, you'll see how this is leading all to a practice. So just let this all come into your being. Even the energy of our discussion can be used for our betterment and fulfillment. So training of the ego, vanity. Man has the desire to do good and to refrain from doing evil because to do so feeds his vanity. That's interesting. A man has the desire to do good and to refrain from doing evil because to do so feeds his vanity. Among 1,000 good and virtuous people, there is scarcely one who does good and refrains from evil because that is his natural inclination. Among 1,000 good and virtuous people, there is scarcely one who does good and refrains from evil because that is his natural inclination. A majority of those engaged in art, in science, in religion, in politics, are conscious all the time of the opinion of others. And they can only work upon the lines they are following if appreciation comes from some quarter. The least antagonism or opposition discourages them and often kills their desire. I encourage my students at the college to be revolutionaries. Well, if you're a revolutionary, you cannot be necessarily of the popular opinion. And really, all the great artists, inventors, designers weren't. They changed things because they went against those traditions, and they gave new vision and form to the world. Literary artists, theater, all of it is that way. Science, my God, we'd all still be thinking the world's flat. Come on now. Among thousands, it is one great soul that can keep firm and strong in his purpose through life, unshaken and unweakened by opposition from any side. It is that person who wins in the end and accomplishes things that are worthwhile. Among thousands is one great soul that can keep firm and strong in his purpose through life, unshaken and unweakened by opposition from any side. Jesus Christ is a good example. It is that person who wins in the end and accomplishes things that are worthwhile. Who would think that a person at age 33, tried like a common criminal and crucified, could have the effect that he's had upon the world? Okay, enough. Just one example. There's many, many such examples. In the lives of all the great souls who have accomplished wonderful deeds in life, you will surely find this mystery hidden. Again, in the lives of all the great souls who have accomplished wonderful deeds in life, you will surely find this mystery hidden. Those souls have not learned it. It happens to be their nature. And the thinker will see in this a philosophy which teaches that it is the ego that chains man's feet, keeping him from progress in all paths of life. The ego not only makes man self-conscious, but it makes of him a coward and renders him helpless. The ego not only makes a man self-conscious, but it makes him a coward and renders him helpless. He is timid because he sees his own limitations. And he is helpless because everything stronger overpowers him as he confines his being within a certain limit. He is timid because he sees his own limitations, and he is helpless because everything stronger overpowers him as he confines his being within a certain limit. Besides all the other disadvantages that self-consciousness brings with it, there is about all else one thing it does. It prevents man from realizing that the thought of self keeps him away from God. Besides all the other disadvantages that self-consciousness brings with it, there is about all else one thing it does. It prevents man from realizing that the thought of self keeps him away from God. In the heart of man, there is room for only one, either himself or for God. In the heart of man, there is room for only one, either for himself or for God. So tune within and consider this phrase. And I might suggest, we're leading to a somewhat esoteric practice that it permeates all traditions. We use it in Sufism also, where it's an alternate nostril breathing. But first, let's just use the breath. And the breath, we think it goes in and out through just these nostrils, but the truth is it goes in and out of every fiber and molecule of our being. We can use the breath to go through and touch and permeate through our skin and the fascia and the muscles, the bones, and touching all the organs. This is the body. This is what Mercer talks about, the three parts of the ego. One is the body ego. This is not altogether bad. This ego helps us to take proper care of the body, to bathe it, to shelter it, to feed it properly. Those are the wonderful aspects of ego. But when the desire becomes greater, the need to gratify the body unnecessarily or excessively, we know that that can be harmful. And then the ego of that part of our being has control. We're using the breath here to purify and revivify, to clarify this part of the ego. Let the breath take you inward. Inward. When thoughts arise, just let them be and return to the breath. Awareness of the breath. Unity in the breath. One is either filled with oneself, thoughts of oneself, or thoughts of God, beingness of God. Now it's interesting to think, what am I beyond this body? Mercer talks about the realm of mind, the realm of mind, thoughts. Thoughts are somewhat concrete. They're very concrete. And we bring them into materialization in the world, in the physical world. So the mind contains faults, yet another aspect of ego. We've given the analogy before in this class of the coconut. The coconut has that hard, rather rough, kind of hairy exterior that can take a good pounding before you can crack that coconut. But when you get beneath that hard shell, then you have this white flesh that's a little softer. And in the realm of mind and thoughts, things are much more malleable, a little softer, but still takes some kind of form. And deeper still is this impulse of feeling. Mercer Hazard and I Khan talks about that as more of a higher form. It's beyond reason and thought, and it's beyond the body, or one could say deeper. So this feeling realm. And it's much more fluid, we could say. We relate feelings and emotions to the water element in Sufism. And this is like the clear milk within the coconut. It can swish around and move around easily. Feelings sometimes can be very fleeting, we know that. It's our thoughts that perpetuate them. But feelings themselves, very fleeting. Fluid. Now we can take these thoughts and repeat them again in the realm of thought, and we can even concretize them for better or for good in the body and in the world. Deeper and deeper. And you know, the center of that coconut is just space. Space. It is the core of the coconut, and yet there's nothing there. It's like our essential self that is pure, that is clear. One might say it's the soul. It's empty. The analogy is frequently given, and we see this metaphor or the analogy in a number of traditions of the mirror. The mirror in and of itself is empty, but whatever images come before it, the mirror reflects. But in and of itself, it is empty. So it's as if there are these layers. St. Teresa of Avila would talk about peeling the layers of the onion, getting to that sweet kernel of the onion, getting through all of that part that is hot, that is perhaps unpleasant, that even makes us cry the tears from the fumes of the onion, but getting down to that sweet kernel, or we might even say, like the beautiful pearl that's inside of an oyster, but it comes from that sand that creates a kind of agitation, and then it forms something beautiful. But if we can find, even for a moment, a glimpse of the spaciousness of our being that actually is so encapsulated, and as Murshid would say, imprisoned and limited by these feelings and thoughts and the physical manifestation of those, we are limitless.